It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The curfew is lifted this morning in Pittsburgh after a weekend that saw peaceful protests in the city turn violent over the death of George Floyd, an unarmed African-American man killed by police last week in Minneapolis.
Today because I'm tired of watching my people die in the middle of the street and their own homes in their own beds. I'm tired of looking towards the people that I love, looking in the mirror and thinking that I'm going to be next or they are going to be next. And I'm tired of our government not doing anything about it.
You know, and I understand, you know, what happened is definitely wrong, but I just don't see breaking into people's businesses how that's going to help anything.
But for us, war is in the mirror. War is at our front door. War is in our school book.
You know, and we don't do nothing about it. And now that we do something about it, they call us, you know, they call us angry, they call us ghetto. Even when we're peaceful, but when we're peaceful, you know, we don't get nothing accomplished.
Why did Mr. Troy Floyd have to die?
He didn't.
He did. He
did
not. He didn't have to die.
No, he didn't.
Every police officer on that scene need to be charged, arrested, and convicted.
Some of the voices from Saturday's protests in downtown Pittsburgh. More than 40 people were arrested. Storefronts were vandalized. Police cars set afire. But the weekend did conclude peacefully at a vigil in East Liberty. Joining me are WESA reporters Anlie Herring and Sarah Schneider, as well as Nate Smallwood, a photojournalist for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Anlie, let's start with you. Briefly summarize, what did you see Saturday afternoon and how it progressed?
So the day unfolded over a number of hours. The march started peacefully downtown at Liberty Avenue and 6th Street near Market Square. That was around 2:30 in the afternoon, and it was a massive crowd, thousands of people. I saw some estimates ranging from 3,000 to 5,000. But it's fair to say entire streets were filled, and people essentially snaked from that area near Market District through downtown up to the Lower Hill near Duquesne's campus. And things sort of that march ended at PPG Paints Arena, and that's where things really took a turn for the worst. That's when the violence and chaos started to break out. And essentially what triggered all of that was there were a few people who had come out for the protest who started to smash a police vehicle on Center Avenue just north of the arena off Washington Place. And that provoked officers who were mounted on horseback, and they came charging into the group, and that led people to just start fleeing. I was right there. It was pretty frightening, I will say.
Okay.
Just the sheer number of people, and that's when things really started to devolve.
All right, Nate, let's get your impressions briefly of what you experienced, what you saw at that time.
At that time, I was not far from there, and my colleague Shane Dunlap was kind of right in the midst of it and has made some very compelling photos of people trying to kind of escape the chaos and the mayhem. I got there not soon after that, and unfortunately ran over and witnessed the Ian Smith from KDKA being assaulted by a group of people. And from that point on, I think a lot of people kind of noticed that the feeling and the demographic even of the crowd and the presence was changing. And there was a much different feeling from what we saw earlier that day.
Nate, you mentioned the reporter being injured. Some journalists were threatened, some injured. Nate and Anlie, did you feel threatened? Nate first.
Yes, to a certain extent, but I was working with a good friend, colleague from Public Source, Nick Childers, and, you know, kind of the buddy system. There's always strength in numbers, and when Ian went down, we went over and tried to do what we could to help. So So I think if we weren't sticking together, it might have been a much different feeling. I know that, you know, Shane, my colleague Shane, being in the midst of it and kind of losing track of where people, you know, myself and other people that kind of could stay near him and help kind of protect each other were, kind of, you know, self-preservation kicks in, and you kind of, you don't know who is a threat and who isn't. And, yeah.
Right. Anley, you mentioned the massive numbers. Did you feel threatened at all?
The situation certainly was dangerous. So I felt as threatened as anyone else there. I did not feel as though I was targeted because I was a journalist. I clearly was. I had my large shotgun microphone with me, which would make it pretty obvious that I was there recording the events. But I would say I was as scared as anyone else would be, as just someone who is there in this mass of people where violence had broken out.
Right. Well, let's bring Sarah Schneider into the conversation. Sarah, you covered yesterday's demonstrations in downtown Pittsburgh. Compare, contrast to what we just heard from Nate and Anley.
Yeah, it was a much smaller crowd. Most of the attendees, I would say, led by young Black people. They were mostly in their 20s and 30s. They probably filled about half of a city block, so a little bit smaller. It started at Market Square. They marched down Grant Street to the city county building. That's where they stood and chanted and spray painted George Floyd's last words, "I can't breathe," also Black Lives Matter. And then they moved to the intersection of Grant and Fifth in front of the city courthouse. And that's where, at least by my count, there were about 40 sheriff's deputies surrounding the building in riot gear with what looked like plexiglass shields. And that's where protesters and the deputies kind of faced off for a while. The deputies remained silent and stoic as there was a lot of hurt and pain, right, from the protesters, just telling their stories of dealing with police brutality.
But not the repeat violence that was experienced on Saturday?
No. They spray painted for a while, and then, there were some interesting moving moments where they're talking to these police officers who are not talking back. And that went on for some time. And the young people, you know, repeatedly were asking, "We want to shake your hands." They wanted to shake the hands of the police officers and then leave. And that went on for a long time, and that didn't happen. Eventually, the police officers put out their fists and did fist bump some of the attendees, and then the crowd cheered and many of them dispersed without incident.
Nate, you're a photographer. Give us an idea of some of the striking images that you saw that will linger with you.
You know, as a photojournalist working in the age of COVID-19, myself and a lot of my colleagues have found it really hard to navigate how to show emotion in scenes like this when so many people are covering half of their face. It's kind of a challenge. But Saturday, I mean, the pain in people's eyes was crystal clear. You couldn't not see that. The tears, the body language of people propping up their neighbors, and towards the end, the anger was laid bare. I think that, you know, it seems like a cry for help, and they call it a cry for help because the cry is loud. It's not a soft-spoken request for help. It's not a murmur for help. It's loud and it's rude at times. But I think now that it gets your attention, and I think it's on us as journalists now to look at what changes are being requested and what is being done now. Because kind of my worst fear is that we go back and in X amount of days, we'll be having the same conversation about a different name.
You've all covered protests before. I'm thinking in particular the shooting death of 17-year-old Antoine Rose 2 years ago this month. by an East Pittsburgh police officer. How would you compare this weekend to that or other protests about police misconduct toward African Americans? Anlie, let's start with you.
This protest was larger than anything I observed during the protests over Antoine Rose's death. I did notice somewhat of a shift in approach to the media, I will say, among the major march organizers. They made a point to tell people who had attended the march this weekend to make room for the media. They seemed very open to the coverage, whereas that didn't always happen with the Antoine Rose rallies. So that was just something that I noted that I found interesting and have been thinking about. Mm-hmm. But you heard a lot of the same chants and sentiments and this continued sense of weariness that this is happening again. And we've been calling for the same reforms for years now. And there is just this sense of disappointment and sadness and rage, just a lot of emotions.
Briefly, Nate, a comparison for you?
Yeah, I think last summer's protests were just a completely different feel, really. I mean, the anger was much more directed at a specific borough, even, of police. The protesters realized that, you know, the Pittsburgh police weren't the source of their anger, and that there was kind of, now feels much more generalized, that this is much more against a systemic problem. But I think the frustration is uncomfortably familiar. I mean, I think also when so much in the world around us has changed over the course of the last 3 months, it compounds the anger and the frustration that some things like this haven't changed.
Sarah, in a sentence or two, the weekend wrapped up with a vigil last evening in East Liberty. Tell us very briefly what the message was there.
Yeah, our colleague Margaret Krause covered the prayer vigil. The message was the need for love, you know, as hate has divided people. And a pastor prayed for white people to consider their own actions. What was interesting is many speakers asked people to go back home and work, continue to do the work.
Right. Sarah Schneider and Anlie Herring are WESA reporters. Nate Smallwood is a photojournalist with the Pittsburgh Tribune. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Poet Patricia Jabe Wesley was born in Liberia, but she and her family fled her country's brutal civil war in 1991. Since 2005, she has taught at Penn State Altoona. Jabe Wesley's latest book is Praise Song for My Children, New and Selected Poems. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll asked her to read from the title poem.
Let me sing to you, my daughters. You have never known where we come from. You who will never know your mother's tongue. You who have become the metaphor of lost warriors who were captured by war. Let me be your songwriter, the song you sing, the dirge you do not know how to sing.
Thank you. That's beautiful. Can you talk about the idea of the praise song? Because I understand that a praise song is a very specific kind of African poetic form.
Yes, the praise song is one of the many different poetic branches of the poetics of the African way of life. There are praise names and praise songs and praise dirges. The entire poem is traditional, the way a grandmother would sing to her grandchildren and a woman would sing to her children at a ceremony, you know.
Another big theme of your work, of course, is about going home in the sense of home and your relationship with Liberia. And one of the poems, November 12th, 2015, it ends with a line that I wanted to read. November 12th, no matter how ugly they say home looks, there's never a day when you do not want to go back home. Could you talk about that line a little bit?
I was thinking of the whole idea of how our countries in Africa and our homelands are painted by the Western media and the Western world. And I was thinking of the whole idea of home. Home is home, no matter what people think. If the people are vibrant and happy and resilient and they're wonderful culturally, and if they, you know that there is something great about where you come from. The whole idea that people say, oh, Africa is this, Africa is this. There's so many people living in Africa and happy to live there, even Americans. And so I say to myself, that's my home. No matter how ugly they say my home is, no matter how terrible it may seem, that's where I come from. And my history and who I am and what makes me tick is African.
You write a lot about how your relationship with Liberia has also changed over the years, even though it's still home to you. Can you talk about that, how your relationship with your home country has changed?
Having lived in America for almost three decades, and even after a decade, you become a different person. So you are part American and part African, and you never know how different you are until you go back home. Okay, so you go back home, you are this so-called African poet who is making a lot of noise, writing a lot of crap about being African, and you go home and you realize you are more American than you thought.
I wanted to ask if you feel like an adopted place can ever be home.
I still think of Michigan as my home. My other home is because they have a Dutch culture of Dutch people who came, who immigrated to the United States during the Second World War. And some of them still have the accent today and the European accent. And those people were my first friends, and they understood what it meant to lose home and family and country to a war. And so they attached to me in a way that was unique, that made some of them seem like family.
Poet Patricia Jabe Wesley speaking with WESA's Bill O'Driscoll. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.fm, where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at WESA.fm/confluence. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, Doug Shugerts, and Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Have a good day of good news.